Hello, I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. These lectures are part of the Great Courses on Tape series. The Great Courses on Tape cover a broad array of university-level disciplines. The lectures in each course are either 30 or 45 minutes long. By listening for less than an hour a day, you could finish even the longest course in just weeks. Browse our catalog or website and imagine how much you could learn if you spent just 30 minutes a day for the next year in the best college classrooms in the world. The lecturers are university professors carefully selected by the teaching company and its customers for intellectual distinction and teaching excellence. The lectures on these tapes are titled Understanding Literature and Life, Drama, Poetry, and Narrative. Part 1, Drama. The speaker is Professor Arnold Weinstein of Brown University. Professor Weinstein received his undergraduate degree from Princeton University and his master's and doctoral degrees from Harvard University. He has taught at Brown University since 1968, where he has received great recognition for his teaching, including the Undergraduate Teaching Award in the Humanities. Professor Weinstein also serves as the chairperson of the Advisory Council on Comparative Literature at Princeton University. Lesson 1. Why Literature? Civilization and Its Discontents.
I'd like to say something in this first lecture about the big issues that frame this course and that frame the study of literature. I'm calling the lecture, Why Literature? Civilization and Its Discontents. And I also want in this lecture to speak about the particular role that drama plays in the study of literature and the particular features of drama that I think make it a very fascinating kind of study. It's no secret in our culture that literature, the study of literature, the reading of great literature, receives a great deal of lip service, but rather less real credence. Often people, without acknowledging it, regard literature as polish, as frills, as quotable nuggets of wisdom that you can pull out at parties and talk. And I think that people study literature at the university partly for those kinds of reasons. It has to do with being educated. It has to do with a certain kind of cultural refinement. If that were all it was, I wouldn't be interested in teaching it, and I wouldn't be here in front of you today. I want to make a much larger claim, which you're certainly free not to subscribe to, which is that we read fundamentally in order to expand and to enrich our estate. That reading constitutes a kind of unparalleled access to the feelings, to the discoveries, to the wisdom, to the flaws and mistakes, and above all, to the life of the past, of other times, of other people. That it's impossible to overestimate the importance of that, because in our own lives, we only go around once, and we are locked into our own mindset, and we are essentially condemned to see the world only via our own equipment. Literature offers a kind of magic opportunity to poach, to have vicarious experiences, to not only encounter, but to actually feel something of the lives of others. Needless to say, in our relationships with people, we attempt to do these things, and of course, we all know how hard it is. In literature, it is also hard, but it is possible, and it is, in a sense, a kind of existential enterprise that comes with different price tags from those of our relationships with people. So I want to argue that the reading of great books is not like a museum tour. It is not a question of approaching things at a distance and genuflecting and knowing the important data about the text or the author. Instead, it's an experiential entry. It's a privileged record, special record, of what life has been about, what it's really been like. The subtitle of this lecture, Civilization and Its Discontents, you probably recognize as the title of one of Freud's major late texts. And I'm going to simplify it enormously, but it's a whole theory of culture that Freud articulates in this book. And in its most simple form, it's a way of saying that civilization and natural behavior are incompatible with each other. That civilization is a complicated form of repression. That our appetites tend not just necessarily to be criminal, but that they tend to want to do things that all cultural forms deny, and that rather than being in a culture where there are police out there who are enforcing the laws and rules, the very nature of civilization is that we internalize these constraints, these denials, that we are our own police state. The line in Blake, which you will hear about, of course, is mind-forged manacles, that we keep ourselves in check. Freud recognizes that. Most of us keep ourselves in check. On the other hand, what he argues is that within our libidinal machinery, within our own instinctual drives, things are never so calm or peaceful. This is always a form of battle. There is always a struggle here. Freud essentially takes the view that the prescriptions of religion, such as the Christian prescription of turn the other cheek or love thy neighbor as thyself, are naive fictions, that it is a wonderful thing to prescribe, but that the human animal cannot believe it, that we are instead governed by our own instinctual needs, that the ego has its own wants, and that if we don't recognize this, we are blind to the actual nature of ourselves and our fellows. Now, Freud does not particularly highlight art as a record of these matters. He tends to think of art as an evasion of sorts, but I'm going to highlight art. My view in using this as a subtitle and in presenting this course and in teaching literature, actually, is that art is a very special record of the kinds of conflicts that Freud talks about. That art is the great subjective record of how people lived, what they loved, what they feared, what they desired. And in saying that, I'm trying to say we don't have much evidence of those things. We can quantify lots of things. We know how much trade people did, how long they lived, what diseases they had, how much money they made, who they married, when they were born, when they died, etc. But we don't have much on record, because we don't leave records like this usually, of what the inner experience was like. Art is that. That's what the artists yield. That's what they bequeath to us. And I think, therefore, that we have much to learn in looking at the work of art that others have produced. We are moved by attending to this record, and I want to suggest that we can also be empowered by attending to this record, that it expands our own repertory. It gives us a wider, enhanced, deepened sense of human possibility of what it is that others have thought and done and felt. So art makes visible. It's a kind of map, but a special map. It's a map that I would compare to a thermal photograph in that it shows intensities of feeling, and very often intensities of conflict, of crisis, of dream, that are not easily seen in any other way. And I'm going to list a number of kinds of binarisms, of pairings, that I think help structure the work of art and that tell us something about Freud's notion of civilization and its discontents. These are all tugs of war. One of them, and many of them are cliché-like, the conflict between reason and passion, the conflict between form and flux, the tug of war between madness and sanity, the conflict between freedom and bondage, the conflict between innocence and experience, a term that the poet Blake is going to use, the conflict between body and soul that has been with us ever since classical antiquity and is particularly one of the strong points of the Christian ethos. Art negotiates these issues. It makes them visible. It makes the conflict visible. Art can be likened, in fact, to a kind of palimpsest, which is the term that is used to describe the older text that we have in which there are several layers of writing, so that we see immediately the surface layer, but the more we attend to the work of art, we see the subtending layers, the layers that are underneath and that are frequently at odds with the surface layer. Art, then, is dimensional in that way. It has a kind of thickness to it. In saying that, I'm trying to argue that we must reject the view that a work of art is a kind of timeless distillation of order. I think we have to reject that view, and I also think that view is a fairly common view, that works of art give us a kind of perfect picture of a time and a place, and that when we read them, we can walk away with a clear sense of what their message is. Instead, I want to suggest that the work of art, at least as I'm going to try to present it in this program, is invariably a site of conflict. It's a place where conflicting forces do battle. The work of art is multivalent, multivocal, often enigmatic and riddling. This is true for a number of reasons, and I'll refer to a number of contemporary theories that also buttress this opinion. One of the theories is the theory of deconstruction, which often appears very esoteric to many people. But in its simplest lines, the deconstructionists argue that language, all language, is much more inconclusive, much more discontinuous, much more riddled with conflict and contradiction than we realize. In other words, if you look at any kind of a statement and you look at it through the eyes of a deconstructive critic, you begin to realize that this statement is rife with its own opposites, that language rarely has the kind of closure and clarity that we tend to expect or that we tend to believe. And this is particularly true of the language of art, that it enjoys a kind of richness and ambiguity and multiple meanings, but that even if it aimed for clarity, it would be difficult for it to achieve it. Another notion I would bring to mind is the work that is being done in a large field in the academy that's called cultural studies, or it used to be called the New Historicism. And what it suggests is that even though, let's assume that the writer, the playwright, has a very particular vision, a very particular message that he or she wants to put forth, what the cultural critics explain to us is that the work itself can never have that kind of clarity and control because the artist is willy-nilly situated within a larger cultural framework, and that there is much flowing into the artist and into the work that the artist cannot be conscious of, cannot know about, which is true for all of us. We are conditioned. We are part of an ecosystem, a cultural ecosystem, as well as a physical and biological ecosystem. And that we are, in some sense, inscribed in systems of belief that we don't even see clearly. They are what we are. They're the air that we breathe. We don't see them. We can't see their lineaments and their contours, but we speak them. We actualize them all the time. So this view would suggest that, therefore, any artist's production, any text that we read, is filled with subtexts, with other voices, whispered voices, other kinds of voices. People have argued the same is true for language, that every time we speak, many groups are speaking through us, not groups that we even know about, groups that somehow make up part of the culture, and that great writing in particular has a welter of different kinds of voices in it. All of these views suggest that there can be no simple, bottom line, univalent, clear picture of a work of art. And by that, I'd like to suggest, therefore, that when we say art creates order, I mean, after all, one reason that people read books and poems is that they know that their own lives are murky, and they know that they read the papers and they see that the life around them is murky and filled with contradiction, with very little pattern. And so art could seem like a very desirable, seductive, safe retreat. Well, there is some truth to that. Art does give us a picture. I don't want to argue that art is just chaotic. It gives us a picture. It contains its rival forces. It packages them. It wraps them up in some fashion. It arranges its material. It is artful, obviously. So that when Shakespeare writes Othello, he gives us a very rich picture that is very controlled of the bristling cultural forces of his moment. But I want to add that art also creates chaos. It doesn't just create order. It creates chaos in this sense. It makes us realize how brittle, often how illusory, often how specious order is. That when we read texts about the past and about our own moment, we are often appropriately disturbed by them. That they complicate our lives rather than simplify our lives. That they show us that the other moments of history that we're reading about were hardly as clear and sort of one-liner tagged as we tend to think. Art makes us see the speciousness of unity frequently, the speciousness of harmony. It makes us understand the silencing of some voices as well as the utterance of other voices. So that these notions of order and chaos are very consistent with the Freudian view of civilization and its discontents. And I want to spell out the fact that the aesthetic order of art is not inhospitable to chaos either. One thinks of Shakespeare's sonnets. The sonnet is absolutely a clear, formal arrangement. It has its very precise, rigorous, demanding requirements. It can be 14 lines long. It has a very specific metric scheme. It has a very specific rhyme scheme. And yet, within that, there can be an enormous amount of disorder, an enormous amount of feeling that is unresolved, of tug of war, of tension, and often of things that are unresolvable, that are expressed within those neat, framed, verbal order. So it's important, I think, to see that. Likewise, texts that appear to be chaotic, such as a play that we will look at in this course, a Buchner's play, Woyzeck, that appear to be episodic, random, sort of taken sort of blindly and thrown onto the stage, once we examine them, we begin to see in them not only a pattern, but something of the rigor of a trap. So we have to be, I think, both interested and cautious about those notions of order and chaos as we read literature, and to see that beneath the most shiny, formal kinds of texts, often there lurks a great deal of unresolved tension, and that's part of the life, the pulse of this work. And that also beneath the texts that appear to be aimless or random or maddeningly unreadable, if we attend to them, we often see pattern, we often see design. Theater is especially suited, I think, to render Freud's view of culture, to give form to those social, cultural conflicts that I've mentioned. The notion of agon, the Greek term which means conflict and struggle, is the very soul of theater. We're going to see it in each of the theatrical texts that we look at. It's important to realize that theater, unlike the novel and unlike poetry, theater is a social form and it's an embodied form. It is true that for many of us, our greatest access to theater is to read theatrical texts in the form of a page with print on it. And Shakespeare and others, of course, wrote down their screenplays. However, screenplays, wrote down the dramatic text. However, let us never confuse the dramatic text with the dramatic performance. One critic many years ago suggested that there are many languages of the theater, of which the most obvious for us is verbal, what the characters, what the players say to one another. It should equally be the case, however, that we understand that the theater has other modes of expression, that the stage itself plays a role, music, dance, lighting, costume, all of these are languages, all of these are ways in which the playwright expresses his or her vision. So that theatrical texts, and this is something to bear in mind when we read them, always have more to them than is on the page. It requires a kind of imaginative investment on our part to see exactly what is happening on the stage. There are moments in Othello where Othello falls into rage and has an epileptic fit of sorts. Or there are moments in Molière where someone is hiding underneath a table, or where there are gags going on. In Beckett's play, Godot, people are constantly doing little tricks. They're doing hat tricks, and they're doing tricks taking their shoes on and off. None of this is verbal, particularly, but I can promise you that when you see these plays on the stage, this is captivating. This is where much of the meaning of the play resides. So it's in that sense that theatrical work has a kind of multidimensionality to it. It's more than just the literary side of it. It represents the notion of agon, in particular, however, as a place where different subjectivities, different sensibilities come into interaction, come into resolution, and come into conflict. That is the soul of theater. You can't have, I mean, there are plays where someone simply does a monologue or a soliloquy, but most of the plays that we are interested in are plays where there are several figures on the stage, and they usually are in conflict with each other, or they are trying to understand one another but cannot. That is what theater as a genre, as a medium, is equipped to show us. It is a fact of life as well, but again, locked into our own private mindsets, bumping into other people throughout our lives, we are very much benefited by seeing the kind of egalitarian logic of the stage, where all of these things have their due, where each of them has its own reality. It's also the case that the conflicts, the agon, as I said, in the plays that we're going to be reading in this course, are large cultural, historical conflicts. They are of their moment, that when we read the Oedipus, we are going to be concerned with huge questions like, what are the measures of the human? What is the scale of the human? What is the status of oracles? What is the power of the gods? Questions that exercise the Greeks. When we read Othello, we're going to see that the agon there, the conflict, has to do with the emergence of a very ugly new world order embodied in the figure of Iago, called the Machiavel. And it's a kind of onslaught against most of the most cherished ideals of Renaissance culture. When we read Molière's play Tartuffe, we're going to see that it also works entirely around the conflict between a very stable moral social order of both the family and the court on the one hand, and the kind of power of lunacy, of obsession, of mania that is embodied in two of the characters of that play. As we move into 19th century work with Buchner's play Woyzeck, we are going to see a kind of real meditation about the origins of violence, what produces violence, what produces sexual violence, what produces violence between men and women. And also, Buchner is among the first, is I think the very first, to put center stage the figure of the worker, of what it means to be a proletarian figure in a world that is controlled by figures of a higher class. At the end of the 19th century, we will look at Strindberg's play, The Father, and we will see that it's a very corrosive and a very, I think, disturbing analysis of what marriage consists of and what male prerogatives in late 19th century Sweden look like. And it turns out to be a kind of fascinating critique of patriarchy as well. And by the time we move into the 20th century with Beckett's play Godot, we see the leveling of all kinds of meaningful acts and gestures, which results really in a kind of absurdist comedy ballet, which was written some 50 years ago, and which I think inaugurates us into our own era. These are all agons, crises, conflicts that speak volumes about their particular cultural moment. But they also speak volumes to us about our own possibilities. That, taking, for example, Godot, we know that one of its most important performances was in the prison at San Quentin. It was put on stage for the inmates at San Quentin, and they understood what it was about, much unlike many of the critics who were reading it. And we also know that in our moment, Susan Sontag went to Sarajevo and put on Godot, and this in the last year, put it on, and with the unerring sense that here, too, is a place where Beckett's text makes sense, where these people will know what this text is about. So that these texts speak their moment, but they also speak our moment, and it's in that sense that I said they can be regarded as repertories, repertories that widen our own take and optic about what life pertains to. There are parables about belief, about the shape and the worth of a life, about how the individual destiny is also the residue of cultural forces. And then they open wide the rather narrow precincts where most of us live. So we enter these texts of the past, as far back as 5th century BC for the Oedipus, and what usually happens is that we initially find that they are like us. And that's what I've been talking about, because otherwise we couldn't read them. Otherwise they would be unintelligible. They are like us. We too can identify with the Oedipus. We can identify with Tartuffe. We can identify with Shakespeare. But an important second step here is that once we recognize how like us they are, we begin to see how unlike us they are. This is one of the great rewards of reading material from the past, is that it allows us an entry into worlds that are not ours. And then we begin to see how things do change, how notions of propriety, how notions of sanity even, how notions of belief alter over time. It helps us to see our own conventions, which by definition we cannot see. It's when we look at other cultures and other civilizations and other texts, something of our own lives comes into visibility. The work of art rarely sermonizes. I've suggested reasons why art does not have univalent, clear, single, simple meanings. It can't. The nature of its language, the nature of the culturally inscribed author, all of that militates against that. And I'm pushing this point because we seem to want to choke text that we read into a bottom line argument. We want to be able to close the book and sort of rub our hands together and say, well, we've gotten that. We see that. We know what that means. And I'd like to suggest that art never indulges that. That every time we think a text has a single message or a single moral, I would argue we have misread the text or we have blinded ourselves to the other voices and other aspects of the text. That bottom line thinking makes sense if you are a bookkeeper and perhaps if you're an economist. It does not make sense if you're reading works of art and literature. Life is more than message. It is plenitude. It is the discovery of an immense reality, and it's in that sense that it dwarfs the narrow ethical tags or the narrow conceptual tags that we might want to put on it. The texts of the past live. That Sophocles is interpreted differently in the Renaissance and in the 18th century and 19th century and our day from what he could have been then. Every one of the texts that we're reading has had its own textual history. That Othello looked different to contemporaries of Shakespeare than it could have to the Romantics. Coleridge was the one who foregrounded Iago, talked about his motiveless malignity. In our day, of course, we are much more drawn to issues of racism and sexism than would have been talked about at an earlier moment. So the texts themselves alter. When you read a great text and you know something about its history, it is a kind of nugget-like history lesson itself. But art is more than a passport to the past. It is also a wake-up call to the drama of one's own moment, and it is a way of widening, as I said, our own optic. And I hope it's a way of coming to terms with the darkness of life. And I make this point because very often people feel that the great texts are rather gloomy and depressing, and most of the texts that we're reading are not very happy. It's not fun to discover that you are married to your mother and that you murdered your father, or that you strangled your wife for betrayal but only to discover that she's innocent, or that you want to murder your wife but you can't afford to buy the knife, or that you don't really have any idea whether your child is your own, or that you find that it's very hard to stand up straight. Somehow you find yourself horizontal and supine all the time. That's going to be, in fact, the situation for most of the plays that we're going to read. The one comedy we read, Tartuffe, is not really side-splitting in its depiction of a viper who enters the family. But the horror in art is, on the one hand, purgative. It allows us to release our own tensions. But it also expands our sense of things. It ruptures our notions of normality and probability. And it is art. We experience works of art, but we experience them vicariously. So that works of art that are about parricide and incest and murder, they allow us to approach these issues, which are part of life, to experience them even, but not to commit them, not to do them. And this may sound deeply pragmatic, what I'm saying, the safety of art, but I want to say it is a unique way to sidle up to experience, to have experiences vicariously that we do not wish to have in reality. That art is a wonderful sort of training ground for life, a way of experiencing things vicariously in the mind, in the imagination, that widens our own record, brings into us something of the store of human life that we would not have otherwise. It brings into us something of the blood of the past into our own tired circulatory systems, not just the blood of Sophocles and Shakespeare, but the blood of Periclean Athens and of Elizabethan London. All of that is, in some sense, cargoed into us, freighted into us, when we read these texts. And in that sense, They are enriching, disturbing, but empowering. Thank you very much.